Good morning. So last time we talked about various ways of manipulating bits in software, mentioning that, well, in hardware, you know, this is really easy. What does the hardware expose to help the software do that? Started with right shift, so this is moving bits within a register. We mentioned that, well, you know, if we just want to shift the bits over in a register, we have a problem that the register is still going to have the same number of bits. We need to fill in the new bits somehow. And for right shift, we had two good choices on how to do that. So one is we could fill them in with zeros, which we call the logical shift. Another is we can fill them in with zeros or ones, depending on what the sign bit of the original operand was. And it turned out that these two options gave us sort of a close equivalent to division, depending on whether you're dealing with signed or unsigned numbers. That's division by a power of 2. We also mentioned left shift, which is kind of equivalent to multiplication by a power of 2, which is in the other direction, and we shifted zeros because, well, that was making sense for that multiplication. Then we wanted to do things with individual bits rather than just moving, you know, the whole register worth of bits around. And we had this idea of bitwise operators. So we had these gates, which in hardware were sort of very efficient operations we could do with particular bits. And the hardware would expose these bitwise operations, which take two numbers and work on every pair of bits doing one of those gate simple operations. And we learned the way we can think about this is as sort of manipulating the bits of one of the numbers, where the other number specifies a mask of what bits to manipulate. And that mask is going to have zeros and ones depending on what we want to do to each bit of the other number. And as far as thinking about these masks, if we bitwise AND with something, the mask tells us which bits to keep with ones and which bits to clear with zeros. So if we want to select a particular bit, we bitwise AND it with a mask that has a 1 in that place and zeros everywhere else. Similarly, bitwise OR lets us select bits to either set to 1 or keep unchanged. And bitwise XOR lets us select bits to flip or leave unchanged. And then we started looking at solving some more complex problems with this one, going through this example of the ternary operator, which is what we're going to pick up today. So the ternary operator, this is a thing you can do in C, C++, or Java, which is syntax for basically if X, then it gives you Y, otherwise it gives you Z. And we saw that in doing this, one trick to help us do this in terms of bitwise operations is to do sort of some problems where we say we're going to get something that's either the result we want or zero, and we're also going to have another subproblem where you get something you want or zero, and we can bitwise OR them together. The idea is that if one's zero and we bitwise OR it with the other that's not zero, we're going to get the other value because ORing with zero gives us the same thing we started with. And ORing is also, you know, commutative. So that's where we left off last time. So questions about things we covered last time. Okay, so let's go back to our ternary operator example. So we're doing this if X and Y LC, and we have this divide and conquer where we divided into if X Y L 0 and if X 0 LC, and we're going to bitwise OR these together because we're going to either have Y OR with 0, which is Y, or 0 OR with Z, which is Z. The end. And we mentioned that if X, Y, and Z are just one bit, 0 OR 1, then our first part is X ended with Y, just because that's how AND works. I just figured that out exhaustively. We'll talk maybe a more systematic way I could have figured it out, or like a less brute force way. And the other part is just the opposite of that, like as far as like using X in the opposite way. So I just flip the bits in X. And well, in this case, we actually only care about the least significant bit. So I'm flipping all the bits, but I only care about the last one. And end it with Z. And that's going to give me 0 or 1 depending on what x is. So this is our overall solution. So as an example of how this works, if x is 1 and y is 0 and z is 1, remember this expression is if 1, which is true, then y lc, so it should give us y. And the way it works is we have 1 ended with 0. That's our if x, y, else z, and that's giving us y, which is 0. And we have tilde 1 ended with 1. This is our if x, 0, lc, and this is giving us 0 because we have our tilde 1 has a 0 in the place where the 1 and the z is. We add that together, that we can think of this as saying we're clearing that bit in z and thus getting 0. Okay, so questions about our one-bit solution. So note that we're assuming that x, y, and z are 0 or 1 for this. We're going to relax that assumption next. Questions on how this works before we extend it. Okay. So first, let's observe that this doesn't work if we violate that constraint. So for example, here I have x is 1, y is 4, z is 2. And the result we'd expect is if 1, which is true, then return 4, else return 2, we'd expect 4. But if we actually evaluate what happens, I have 1 ended with 4. This is my if x, or this first part is if x, y else 0 part. So we expect this part to return 4. And what actually happens is we get 1, which in binary is 0, 0, 0, 1, and then with 4, and when we do a bitwise and, we get 0. So that doesn't work. And we also have a problem with the other part, which remember was the if x 0 lc part. In this part, we expect to return 0. But what actually happens is our tilde 1 from our x is all 1s and a 0. And our z has a 1 in the 2's place. And that gives us 2, which is also not what we wanted. So this doesn't work when we violate those 0 or 1 constraints. So we need to do something to fix that. So next I'm going to do a solution where we're still going to have a constraint, and our constraint's going to be that x is 0 or 1. So we're going to assume x is 0 or 1, but we're not going to assume anything about y or z. And I'm going to solve this problem in the same way we did before, as far as the first part, which is I'm going to divide it into the same two subproblems, but I'm going to have to solve these differently because we saw that our two solutions before don't actually work when y or z is bigger than a bit. And let's start with our first problem. So our first subproblem is if x, I want to return y, otherwise I want to return 0. And a way I can think about this is I want to either keep all the bits of y, or I want to keep none of the bits of y. And bitwise and, we can think of as doing this operation. We can select and with something to keep bits or to clear bits. If we and with ones, it keeps those bits. If we and with zeros, it clears those bits. So basically, if x is 1, I want to AND with a bit pattern that's all 1s to keep all the bits. If x is 0, I want to AND with a bit pattern that's all 0s to clear all the bits. And that's going to solve this problem. And so the only thing I need to do here is I need to somehow transform 1 into all 1s and 0 into all 0s. And there's a bunch of ways we could do that. So you might think of the solution where I like do x ord with x shifted over 1 ord with x shifted over 2 and so on. That's, keep going. That would be a way of doing it. There's a simpler solution that's kind of a trick that maybe violates the spirit of using bit manipulation operators, which is that this is just minus x because the bit pattern for -1 is all ones. and you might say this violates the spirit of using grid manipulation operators, because negation is actually a lot more complicated than, you know, bitwise AND or anything like that. All these simpler grid manipulation operators in the hardware, that is. But this is a way we can do that. So this gives me a solution of y ended with minus x is one way we can do this. Questions? Why that works. So sort of the way I found this out is I said, I want to either keep all the bits of y or clear all the bits of y. And I said, well, keeping all the bits of y is bitwise ending with all ones. Clearing all the bits is bitwise ending with all zeros. And I said, how do I turn x into that value to end with? Questions? Okay, so that was our first subproblem. Our second subproblem was the if x 0, else c part. So here, I have the same idea that I'm going to do z anded with a mask, but I want the mask to be all ones when x is 0, and all zeros when x is 1. And there's multiple ways I can do this. One way I can do this is I can say, okay, I'm just going to have to do something to turn x from 0 to 1 or 1 to 0. And one way I can do that, not the only way, is I can XOR x with 1. Another way I could have done this is I could have done 1 minus x to compute that. But I just chose a way of converting 0 to 1 and 1 to 0 and then applied what we did before. Questions? So this gives us our overall solution to this part of z ended with minus x, x order 4. Questions? Comments? Okay. And so we have our one full solution here, where we're mostly using bit manipulation, but we have this negation operator, which isn't really bit manipulation, to do this. But, okay. So we have one constraint here, though. We're still requiring x to be 0 or 1. So this isn't actually equivalent to in C. You know, in C, if you did if x, it would take care of if x is 2 and say, oh, that's still true, and so on. So can we do that? And the answer is going to be, well, yes. And if we were doing this in C, we wanted to implement this in C without if else, the simplest way of doing it would be using the bang operator. So exclamation point x is going to be 1 or 0, and double exclamation point x is going to convert x from, say, anything to 0 or 1, where 0 becomes 0, anything else becomes 1. And if we write this in C, typically the assembly that's generated is going to use the test instruction. So you might think this kind of violates the spirit of avoiding using if statements to solve this problem, because that's kind of how bang is implemented internally, is like using the same mechanism. But if we're comfortable with that, then here's our solution. So I'm using this double exclamation point, which is basically going to convert x to 0 or 1. So and convert, in particular, x equals 0 becomes 0, x not equal to 0 becomes 1. And on the other side, I have a single exclamation point. So x not equal to 0 becomes 1, and x equal to 0, or x not equal to 0 becomes 0, and x equal to 0 becomes 1. So questions on how this sort of overall solution thing, why this works here? Yeah?
Why do you have two exclamation marks?
Why do I have two exclamation marks here? So I'm applying this bang operation twice. When I apply it once, I'm going to turn 0 into 1. which is not what I want for the first part. So I apply it twice to return that 1 back into a 0. So couldn't I omit the whole thing? No, because I also want to turn like 2 into 1 overall. And if we only omitted it, we'd end up with 2. But here, we're going to turn 2 into 0 and 0 into 1, which is why we can get rid of this constraint on x. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So this is a solution, but it might seem a bit unsatisfying because we're taking advantage of basically comparison hardware for figuring out if x is 0 or not. And if we're happy doing that, why aren't we happy like doing a proper if statement? So let's talk about a way of doing that. It might be closer to like how the hardware actually like figures out if a value is 0 or not. And so we're going to talk next about solving the problem of checking if any bit of x is set. And we talked about the EZC solution using the bang operator. And in lab, you also implemented the bang operator, or you may have, if you got that far, implemented the bang operator in terms of addition or subtraction. But we're going to want to use something where we don't rely on these rather complicated operations, something closer to what like the hardware might actually be doing to check if a value is 0. And this seems like kind of a daunting problem. How would I approach doing this? And sort of general strategy I recommend is let's simplify the problem first. Let's find a smaller subproblem. And the smaller subproblem I'm going to use is how do we solve it if x is 4 bits? We could go a bit smaller. So if x is 1 bit, how do we solve it? Well, we just take that 1 bit. That's our answer. If x is 2 bits, how do we solve it? Well, I can bitwise OR the bits together. It's if either of them are set, I want to get a 1. Bitwise OR does that. So if x is 1 bit, it's x. For 2 bits, it's x shifted over 1. Get that bit and OR it with the bottom bit of x. So basically we're combining the 2 bits, and therefore our solution with 4 bits is I take the bottom bit of x with x ended with 1, and then I take the next bit of x here, I'm shifting over x1 and extracting that second least significant bit, then the third one and the fourth one, and I'm bitwise pouring them all together to get the bottom bit. So questions on what I'm doing here? Some people look confused. So here, I'm just using a solution where I'm extracting each bit, ORing them together to get a value which is going to be 1 if any of them are set, because remember, bitwise OR, we can think of it as set it to 1, you know, or keep it the same. So if anything is 1, it's going to set to 1. Okay. So we could extend this into a full solution, but we're going to have a better way. Yes? Question for this solution, I need to know how many bits x is? Yes. And unfortunately, we're not going to get rid of that property. We're going to need to know how many bits there are. But this is going to become a little bit unwieldy if we have 32 or 64 bits. So you got something better. And to figure out how we can get something better, let's look at what happens here. And we're going to find that there's a bunch of work that we're doing that's redundant. So one thing we're doing that's redundant is at each step here, I'm extracting only the bottommost bit, the least significant bit, and clearing all the other bits. What I could do instead is I could let the other bits have weird values until the very last step and then clear all the other bits. And that's going to have the same effect because, you know, because we're not using anything but the least significant bit, and the bitwise OR, it only sets those other bits based on not the least significant bit. So, you know, another way you can say it is that there's a distributive property that OR and AND have that I can take advantage of here. So I can just do that bitwise AND once. And what I'm doing here is I'm just saying, okay, well, there are some other bit values, but we don't care about them. And I'm deciding to clear them at the end instead of at the beginning. And that's going to be the same and save a whole bunch of bitwise AND operations. So questions about why this works? So that saved a little bit, but it's still pretty unwieldy if we extend this to like 32 or 64 bits. Another observation we can make is that we're performing a bunch of bitwise ORs. And if we think of how many operations this is actually doing in the hardware, each of those bitwise ORs is doing 4 ORs in the hardware, because our hardware is taking each of the bits of X and X shifted over 1 and ORing them together, even though we only care about this least significant bit here. All the other bits, we don't care what's happening there. We're not going to use that value. We're going to clear it out later on. So we're doing 4 OR operations using 1. And what we'd like to do is we'd like to take advantage of the fact we're doing all these extra OR operations and use some of those results. So we aren't wasting 3 OR operations every time we do a bitwise OR. And one way we can see how to do this is we can look at, well, what are we doing right now? And if we think of that first bitwise OR operation, we're taking X and X shifted over 1. So I've represented the bits of X as X3, X2, X1, X0. And if we think of the number we're getting, the least significant bit is X1 OR with X0. Then we have X2 OR with X1, X3 OR with X2, and 0 OR with X3. And it happens that even without doing any extra work to arrange things, which we could have tried to do, but without even doing any extra work to arrange bits around, that we're computing not just X1 added with X0, but we're also computing this other part of the value we want. We're computing the 2 shifted over 2 with it shifted over 3. We're just putting it not in the least significant bit, but somewhere else. So if we just extract that other bit there, we can save an OR operation, because we're already doing that OR we were trying to do later. So this first OR operation just happens to compute 2 of the OR operations that are useful to us. And maybe if we were more clever, we could get more than 2 done in this first step. But just with the array things are arranged, we're getting 2 useful OR operations out. Questions? Why we have 2 useful bits here. So to take advantage of that, we can extract the bit that we got out of that intermediate result and OR it together. So I can take Y, which is our result here, shifted over 2, and now I have X1 OR with X0 aligned with X3 OR with X2. So when I do a bitwise OR, they get OR together. And that's our final result, and I did it with fewer bitwise OR operations. Some questions? Computation. And note that I still have a bunch of values in gray, which are values I'm computing I don't actually care about. So it's not like maybe we could do better, probably not for this case, but you know, at least I'm not wasting all the extra values. I'm taking advantage of more of the computations the hardware is doing for me anyway. Questions? Sorry. Okay. So this gives us a solution like this is one way we could solve it for 4 bits. So we can generalize this to more bits. So if I look at what happens with, say, 8 bits, I find out that when I do the same bitwise OR operation, I have a whole bunch of bits, like every other bit, in fact, is useful. And I can shift over and, in fact, do 2 useful OR operations pretty naturally, and I get this sort of tree pattern. And at the end, we're going to move this over to here to do our final result. So you can see that we have this sort of inverted, not inverted, this tree pattern that comes up a lot that is, you know, letting us in the early operations, you know, get a lot of useful results, and later on we're getting down to 1 value, so we have fewer and fewer useful bits, but we're taking basically the best advantage we can of the fact that, oh, bitwise order does multiple operations at once. So questions? Does the final Z do that? We would need to do like a W equals Z shifted over Z over 4. Right, so you have one more step to combine the two parts. Other questions? So I extended this here to 8 bits. We can extend this all the way to, say, 32 bits and get a solution like this. And this sort of pattern comes up a bunch. You know, and a sort of key idea here is that, oh, we can take advantage of the fact that these bitwise operations really are doing multiple calculations at once. If we can use multiple of those calculations, we'll get better use out of them. Okay. So just to mention some general things about bitwise operations for homework hints. So as I mentioned, like, the big strategy we use is we found smaller, simpler problems, solve those first and combine them into bigger problems. A common strategy for this is if I have this subproblem, which is zero or result we want, and another subproblem, which is zero or result we want, I can usually combine those into one bigger result for the main problem. We have this idea of masking and shifting. So a very common thing you want to do is extract particular bits. The usual pattern for that, probably the bitwise operation which comes up the most in practice, is bitwise AND to select some particular bits and shift it to move it to where you want it in the number, typically in the least significant bits. Mention this idea of factoring and distributing. In particular, that, like, if you're ending with 1 to, like, clear all the bits but the least significant one, you can do that later and it's going to be the same. Also, something which comes up on the homework problems is some people really like doing everything in one line, which you can do for the homework problems, but it supports lots of statements, and you should take advantage of that. In particular, we have this solution for our if x, then y, else c problem, and you can simplify that to only compute exclamation point x once. Yeah, but you probably need multiple statements to do that. Don't be afraid to, like, write things out in a readable way to do that. Okay, so to finish up on bitwise operations, let's do this little exercise here. So let's say I have a bunch of bits in x. So x is a number, and I want to swap the least significant and second least significant bits. So if the bits of x are u, v, w, x, y, z, we swap z and y and leave everything else unchanged. I'm asking which of these do that, and I'll give you some time to look over it. You can check with your neighbor. The way I would solve this in general is I would say, okay, we have, let's say our number is u, v, w, x, y, z. That's our pattern. And I see x ended with 1. Well, u, v, if I add this with 1, the pattern I expect is a bunch of zeros and a z. Right? And I work out in that kind of way what happens to each of the bits. That's how I would solve these problems. I'd recommend you a minute or two. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, a bunch of people, okay. Wait a bit. Okay, who'd still like some more time? Okay, so let's see. So who thinks A will do this? B? C? D? Okay, so we have pretty good consensus that C will work, and a few people saying D will, so we'll talk about that. And most people think A and B won't work, so A and B, in fact, won't work. So A, this is sort of the way I figured it out. I said, oh, for this part, we have our bit pattern, which I wrote as just symbolically representing each bit with a letter. So this gets shifted over one, so we shift in a zero. Then we AND with one to get a Y. Then I have this part, which I AND with tilde one, so that's clears all the bits but the last one. So, sorry, clears the last bit and keeps all the bits without that. So we get this value, and we OR these together, and have U ORed with 0, U ORed with V, and so on. So I get UV X, Y, Y, which isn't swapping Y and Z. And for B, similarly, I figure out what each of the parts are here. So I get that this first part gets the last, I guess the second to last bit in the last position. This next part here shifts over in the other direction and gets us to get sort of the bit shifted over by one, starting at the second least significant bit in the third place. And our last part gets all but the last two bits in their normal places. When we OR this together, we're going to end up with Y in the last place, 0, and then we're going to have X ORed with Y, which is not going to make sense in our, as matching our answer. And version 3 must have you figured out. So version 4, so what's going wrong here? So our first part extracts the least significant bit and puts it in the second least significant place. It looks very promising. Our last part extracts the second least significant bit and puts it in the least significant place. Also looks very promising. And then we XOR with X. And the way we can think of this XOR operation, we're going to take 0 XORed with U. That's going to be U, the way XOR works. We can think of this as XORing with 0 doesn't change anything. XORing with 1 flips a bit. And everything looks fine until we get to this Y here, which is going to be XORed with Z. So we have Y XORed with Z, which isn't what we want. Close, but, you know, so this would be fine, for example, if we had replaced X with the last 2 bits cleared, for example. Some questions? I figured that out. I note for I wrote this sort of as all one statement. We could have written this out in a nice, more readable way, which is what I'd recommend for the homework. But don't try to do these. Try to do something more like this so you can debug things. Okay, so our next topic is going to be something a little different. It's about instruction sets. So we talked about operations, instructions that are provided. Talk about instruction sets in general. And one thing you may know if you know about different types of processors is that these different instruction sets are different assembly languages and sets of instructions that are supported and so on. There's a whole bunch of them that are actively manufactured. So there's the 2 most common ones is probably x86 and ARM, but we have sort of a whole bunch of others that are also actively manufactured. And a question might be, and we're going to look at sort of how do these differ? What choices are they making that are different? Why would you make those choices? What would be your motivations be? And to talk about that, we're going to have to distinguish between the design of processors from the design of instruction sets. So microarchitecture is the design of the hardware. So for example, Intel and AMD have different generations of their chips which have a different hardware design. And also, for example, you might have a very different hardware design for low power stuff than sort of desktop stuff, even if the set of instructions you support are the same. Even if you run the exact same programs, you might have a very different design. And a lot of the microarchitectural choices will adjust performance and efficiency, but need not change what software runs. The instruction set is this software visible interface. And by this, I mean what matters for software compatibility. So if 2 things have the same instruction set, I can take a program on one and run it on the other, and vice versa. And this is without any changes, without recompiling. It should just run as is. It looks like the same kind of machine as far as all the software is concerned. This is an important distinction. We're going to be talking about instruction set issues. So that idea in mind, which of these changes to a processor change the instruction set? So they all change the microarchitecture, they change the hardware design, which also change the instruction set. That's software visible interface. You a minute, go over, see if you agree with your neighbors. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A would be an instruction set change? It's increasing the number of registers in assembly. Couple people. B? Decreasing it. Okay, pretty much. No one. C? Diminishing code for add instructions shorter. Few people. D, removing a multiply instruction. Which everyone. E, allowing the add instruction to have two memory operands. Okay, so we have great consensus that D is a sense of change. Now, a thing to remember, as I said, it's the interface visible through the software, and different instruction set is not, like, doesn't mean compatible, it means different. So, for example, allowing the add instruction to have two memory operands means that we have programs on the new processor which won't work on the old. It's a different instruction set. You know, software written for the two processors notices they're different because one they work on one and not the other. And the same is going to be true with increasing the number of registers in assembly. If you have assembly that uses those new registers, doesn't work on the other processor, that's a different instruction set. It's a different software visible interface. And the software interface, we were referring, including the entire software visible interface that includes things that the compiler sees, and the assembler sees, and the operating system sees. So making the machine code different, that's going to be a change to the instruction sets. So we're going to call all of these except changing how fast the add instruction is. That we're not going to call a change to the instruction set. Maybe I should do that in for emphasis in different color. That's not an instruction set change. All the others are. They change what whether software works on one or the other. You know, they're not, you can't just interchange them. So questions about what counts as an instruction set change? Okay. So something which people might find a little confusing, it might have provoked some of you to say that a lot of these weren't instruction set changes, is that, I've been saying x86-64 and ARM are instruction sets. And if you know a bit about how processors for those instructions work and are marketed, you might realize, wait a moment, but they've added new instructions to those things. That's one of the things that happens with new processors, and this is true. So how I would describe this is that there's a bunch of variants of the x86-64 instruction set. And typically the variants are compatible in one direction but not the other, typically, maybe not 100%. And the same with ARM and a lot of other popular sort of instruction sets have lots of different variants out there. I note that when we're talking about new processor designs, it's true that sometimes a new processor will add some instructions, will support a new variant of the ISA, but typically those aren't the big changes that are the purpose of making a new processor design. And the reason you can infer this is that most of the time the processors are marketed for running existing programs better, right? It's not that they'll let you run something new. Typically, it's that they'll let you run your existing programs better is a big selling point, and a lot of the work is going into that. And that's all about the stuff that's part of the original instruction set and doesn't require this new variant of the instruction set. Okay, so you've talked about what instruction sets are. What are some goals we would have in designing an instruction set? So, like we mentioned, there's a bunch of instruction sets. There must be a reason we aren't just using all one. What would goals be, goals people would have in making an instruction set that might make us get different results? Okay, sort of low memory usage might be a goal. And that might make you do things that are different than other instruction sets. Yeah, other set of goals we might have? Yeah. So being efficient, so being simple, and being efficient, I'll write these as separate goals because they might not be the same thing. The choices we make to be efficient might make things less simple, and vice versa. Yeah?
Like capable of performing all the necessary instructions.
Okay, so capable of doing all the operations. So this, I would say, is typically a goal, though it's pretty hard to miss on not being capable, but some of them might be awkward if you aren't careful. Like, if you don't have a multiply instruction, you can probably still multiply, but it might be a lot of extra work. Okay. Other goals we might have? Yeah. So readable, so having readable assembly. That might be a goal. Okay. Anything else? Yeah. Okay, so that's simple. So this might, I call this part of simple, so like few instructions might be a part of that, might be a way that we'd be simple. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so good support, constructs from higher level code. From some, I'll use HLL for high level language. Yeah. Anything else? Okay, so we have a whole bunch of ideas, and this is probably the sorts of thing we're thinking about designing ISAs. And we're not going to go into like great detail, but there's things we might do for each of these. And we can think of them as we're going over some particular ISA design decisions. Those are our next few slides. And we'll get back to probably this concept of efficiency and readable assembly in a little more later when we talk about RISC and CISC. the first sort of general ISO variation. So here's a table of maybe some of the easiest to figure out differences between ISOs. So I have a bunch of instruction sets, and I have the instruction length, the number of normal registers. By normal registers, I mean like RAX, RBX, RCX, and so on. But I'm not like including floating point registers, for example, or condition code registers. And I have the approximate number of instructions. This is approximate partly because it's hard to count instructions. So for example, XV6 has an instruction that adds a constant to a register and adds a register to a register. Some people would say those are different instructions, some would say they're the same instruction. So all these counts are like really approximate for that kind of reason. It's a little debatable what instructions are actually different instructions from each other. But we can see we have like a bunch of variation in these attributes. So in instruction length, we have this big distinction between a bunch of instruction sets that are variable length, where the machine code for instruction can take up a variable amount of space, or fixed size. I guess I should also mention 186 here. This is the instruction set that's a subset of x86 that our textbook uses and will be using later in the semester. Talk all about what it looks like next week. We have variation in the number of normal registers. We seem to have settled on something like 16 or 32, but that's actually a pretty big difference, right? It changes a lot what you can do in assembly, and some instruction sets are way smaller. And also we have Itanium, which is just different in every way. And we have the number of instructions. So a lot of instruction sets are really big. They have lots of instructions to support. And some are pretty small, so Z80 is probably the biggest example. If you remember my slide earlier, I said this is what like TI calculators often use. So it makes sense that a device like that wouldn't have such a complex, big instruction set. And we have other instructions that kind of vary, like ARM is kind of small, and so on. MIPS, small number of instructions. So that's one area we can have sort of these big changes. And you can see how this might kind of reflect philosophies about efficiency or simplicity, you know, what choices we make here. So another choice that instruction sets make is how conditionals work. So we've learned all about condition codes, and since you learned XV6 assembly, you're probably used to this idea that you do a comparison, and then you do this conditional jump. Some instruction sets have said, I don't want to worry about doing condition codes. I don't think that's a good design. So instead, they have single instructions that do a comparison and a conditional jump all at once, rather than having condition codes. And whether you do that or not, that's a design decision. Like, the advantage of doing it the second way is that you don't have condition code registers. The disadvantage is that, like, you have to make jump instructions for all your comparisons that you want to do, rather than having that kind of be separated out. Another big choice is how operands can be specified. This is commonly called, as the slide says, addressing modes. Because most commonly, the variation is in how we can specify locations in memory, but not always. So for example, in XV6, we learned we had this sort of array indexing thing we can do and lots of instructions for specifying an operand. That's specific to XV6. Most other platforms don't, you know, instruction sets haven't decided to support that kind of operand. They support accessing memory, but not like this kind of way. And there's some other weird ways we might specify operands. So for example, in ARM, instead of just specifying a register, and a lot of times you can specify the register shifted over by an amount. You can do a bit shift in the operand, just like we can do like an array index calculation in an operand for an add in x86. That's a design decision they made because they said, oh, bit shifts are really useful. So we'll have them in as part of what how we specify operands includes doing that. Another example is VAX supported letting you do a double pointer to reference as part of an operand. So that's really useful to do. You know, you could do it with an extra instruction, but we're going to make it really convenient. Questions about sort of different operand choices. Obviously, there could be a lot more we could come up with that maybe real instruction sets into, but we could might find useful. Another big choice instruction sets make is how many operands you have. So a bunch of instruction sets have a source, and a destination. So a typical instruction has three operands. Advantage of that? Well, you don't have to move things around all the time. You avoid a lot of move instructions. Disadvantage? Now the machine code has to encode three things instead of two. So it's going to take up more space, maybe not be as memory efficient, and that affects every instruction. So we have a bunch of other instruction sets which have a source and a destination that's also a source. And then you have some instruction sets like facts where they said, well, both of these are convenient, let's do both. Just implement both. We'll have both versions of math. Okay. So I've just gone through sort of many of the sort of big high-level choices. Obviously, there's lots of little choices. And we can see that, you know, these choices sort of reflect different ideas about some trade-offs and or, you know, trying to be simple or not. And there's sort of one big change in philosophy that we're going to talk about, that our textbook also talks about, which is this idea of the reduced instruction set computer. So the reduced instruction set computer was an instruction set design philosophy that's probably most reflected in MIPS and a few other similar instruction sets. That was a big change in how people thought about designing instruction sets. As we'll talk about a bit later, it's not really what modern instruction sets are, but they're very influenced by this change in philosophy. And it says reduced. You might say, what is it reduced from? And I think looking at what was happening in instruction sets before RISC is a good way of understanding like why RISC was such a big change. It's reduced from, well, complex instruction set computer. Well, that's not very useful. But sort of the classic example of a CISC design is VACS. So let's look at some real VACS instructions. So I'll let you read these descriptions. These are instructions, not library functions, instructions on VACS. Like this is assembly. Had a chance to start skimming. So the first one here, this is find string in string as an instruction. And it's variable length, takes length of the string and the substring. We have evaluate a polynomial of whatever length. And we have basically printf for format as an instruction. So these are things VACS did. And if we think about our instruction set design goals, VACS is leaning really heavily into readable assembly and really doesn't care about simplicity. Right, that was what their design philosophy was. But you might say, okay, well, if we have hardware doing all this, that seems really convenient. So a good question you might have is, how would you implement this in hardware? Like this string and string instruction, that's pretty complicated. Like we have to do a loop. So the hardware did a loop? Yeah. How did it do that? And it turns out that the implementation technique for these instructions was this idea of microcode. That basically the hardware would translate these instructions into a different instruction set that was much simpler, which would have like a loop written in this different instruction set of micro instructions. And that's how something like this MACSI instruction was implemented. So there was a secret, simpler instruction set underlying things. And a consequence of this was that these complex instructions weren't really faster than actually just doing the operations manually. Like, you know, doing it with simpler operations because it turned into the same thing anyways. So you could do the same operations with simple instructions, and it would be about the same speed. And we were doing lots of work to implement these complex instructions to make sure all that microcode was right and so on, and tested. And obviously, if you have a bug in your MATCHC implementation, it's going to be a lot harder to upgrade than if you have a bug in your library, your C library implementation of find string and string. But probably the bigger change which provoked, you know, a new instruction set design is that clearly at the time of VAX, they cared about people writing assembly by hand. These are instructions that are really meant to be used by people. And around this time, 70s, 80s, people, compilers, were starting to replace handwritten assembly. And the people who designed the RISC instruction set sort of had two bets, one of which worked out, one of which didn't. One bet they had was that almost no one's going to write assembly anymore. And I think that's basically true. Yes, people still write assembly, but almost all the time, you don't do it. You have compilers do it for you. And that means we don't need to design our instruction sets with humans as the primary users of the assembly language in mind. That we can design them for compilers. And compilers can do a lot of rote work in our assembly that we might not want humans to do. Assumption they had, which maybe didn't work out, is that they thought it would be okay to recompile frequently. So the original RISC philosophy had this idea that, oh, we'll just change the instruction set when we change the hardware all the time, because you'll just recompile. And turns out that people really care about binary machine code compatibility, so that assumption didn't work out. But a lot of the things from the RISC philosophy, in particular this idea that we're targeting making it easy for compilers and exposing sort of things that are efficient in the hardware, is kind of the key goal. Like, we want to expose what the hardware can do to the compiler. We'll have the compiler worry about how do you efficiently find, you know, or the software implementer worry about how do you find a string in a string. That's not our job. Our job is just to expose sort of the hardware operations to the compiler, let it worry about it, because we aren't going to have assembly written by hand anymore. So a typical RISC instruction set design has fewer, simpler instructions. So we're not going to implement these big, complicated instructions. We're going to implement simple instructions and fewer of them, because we're implementing instructions for the compiler to use. The compiler, you know, is doing simpler operations, not like string and string operations. Typically, they have separate instructions to access memory. So to keep things simpler, and because we're not writing assembly by hand anymore, we're going to say that, you know, you have to use basically move instructions to move values from memory to registers and then act in registers. And the advantage of this is that makes the hardware simpler, because we don't have to worry about accessing memory for all types of instructions, just a few of them. So this means you need to, you know, so you need to like move, you know, a value into a register and then add, for example, instead of adding from memory directly, right, with that design. And because, and they generally have fixed length instructions, because that's easier for the hardware to decode. We have as little work for the hardware as far as interpreting the instructions. And also, because we have separate instructions to access memory, and also we have less hardware to implement complicated instructions, we're going to have more registers. So more registers is going to sort of get rid of the disadvantage of moving values from memory to registers being a separate instruction by having more of them, hopefully. And also, that's a way we can use the space on our chip that is now not being used by, you know, all the stuff to implement like that MATCHC instruction. We're going to have, generally, for our instructions, are never going to have loops inside them. So we're never going to have something like find string and string or evaluate a polynomial of an arbitrary length. If you want to do a loop, you're going to have to run You know, if you want to do something n times, you have to run n instructions, basically. Possibly with like conditional jumps, but n instructions. To keep things simple, we're going to have no instructions that access memory twice. So we're going to have our instructions that access memory, and they're going to be loads or stores. They're not going to be some combination. And we're going to have few addressing modes, meaning that we're going to have very few ways of specifying operands to keep our hardware simpler. That we're not going to do what x86 does and have like eight ways of specifying a memory location. We're going to have one or two and say, the compiler can figure out how to do the computation rather than us implementing in the hardware like 10 different options. Because that's not super useful for the compiler. And we can implement efficiently our one or two options rather than trying to implement all 10 options and spending that effort. Okay, so questions about these properties of RISC-like instruction sets? So, told you about these properties of RISC instruction sets, you might say, well, this isn't x86. x86 does not have few instructions. x86 doesn't have separate instructions to access memory. They're not fixed length. It kind of has more registers. They did that when they went to 64-bit. 16's a lot more than it used to be. If you know about x86 instructions, you might know there's some instructions which basically do loops. Mostly there's no instructions with two memory operands, but not quite. And there's lots of addressing modes. You might say, well, x86 is one of the most popular instruction sets today, and it sure isn't RISC-like. Why are we talking about RISC? And probably ARM is a little better, but still a little off. And, well, we really care about backwards compatibility. And also, there's more application-specific instructions out there. But if we look at what compilers are using, and also how x86 is implemented, there's a lot of influence from RISC. So the sort of instructions compilers generate are typically closer to those RISC-like instructions than to those VAX-like instructions, right? Compilers aren't trying to do all the complicated instructions. They're using simple ones. And also, the way x86 is implemented uses this micro-instruction idea. So if you have an instruction that doesn't add accessing memory, add to it from a value of memory, typically the way it's implemented is by internally in the processor turning that into a move from memory and an add. Like it internally is implemented using RISC-like instructions. They just do a translation to support backwards compatibility because commercially speaking, you wouldn't buy a processor where I told you it won't run anything you have. So questions about sort of CISC being the winner? And I'd say looking at the CISC versus RISC sort of contrast is probably, you know, gives you sort of the biggest difference in instruction set design philosophy that's out there. So we have the CISC type of design philosophy is really focused on choosing a good assembly language and making the hardware work with that. Right, that seems to be how they were designing things. Whereas the RISC philosophy is, we know what the hardware can do, we're going to turn that into an efficient thing that exposes what the hardware can do and worry about having the software figure out how to take advantage of that. And typically, modern hardware is closer to this philosophy, but not entirely. But those are sort of two different approaches, right? One approach is kind of, here's what I want the assembly writers to do, let me make that work in the hardware. The other approach is, I'm going to figure out what my hardware can do and make instructions for that. And where I think we're generally closer to the second one, but this is a big difference in philosophy, and both of them are, you know, pretty reasonable to say. And I'm saying these are general differences. It's not like pretty much no modern instruction set is as obviously CISC as VAX, or as obviously RISC as the most RISC-like instruction set is probably MIPS 1 or something like that. like pretty much all instruction sets kind of look like, as far as what philosophy they use, they're in the middle somewhere. So questions about RISC versus CISC? Or instruction sets generally? Okay, so this is where we'll leave off today. So next time, we're going to talk about the YD664 instruction set that we're going to be using for a lot of this.